I don't know what episode number this is.
Hold
on. Is that going to be awkward?
We could do, I'd say XXX, but...
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
So hey there, episode 160 coming at you. This is Seth stepping in for Stephen hosting today. Got Foz on. How you doing, Foz?
I'm well, and yourself?
Can't complain. Just wolfed down some lunch. I finally got a little burst of energy here. See if we can get through this before the sugar crash comes along.
Always good.
Always good. And if not, you know, just have to step over to the bar and help that sugar rush out.
You wouldn't know how to do that.
Inappropriate too at 1:45 in the afternoon?
Never. It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Here's the thing. Why is 5 o'clock a cutoff? Why can't I want to have a drink at 1:45?
You could have a drink at 1:45. I think the 5 o'clock cutoff is because that's when a lot of people end work. Now, if you end work at 1:45, by all means.
Wait, we're not supposed to drink at work?
Well, then if you can drink at work, that just makes it all even better.
Just saying, this life I lead as a journalist might not really comply with most of the normal rules. But anywho, how's that for a great intro? So we've talked a little bit in recent weeks about problems with pilot shortages and routes getting dropped. And we had, I think, Penn Air declared bankruptcy and had to restructure a bunch of flights and closed a couple hubs a few weeks back. Horizon, which is part of the Alaska Air Group, is next on the list there. And over this past weekend, the airline announced 8 different routes are going to get affected. 4 are being dropped completely, and 4 are getting frequencies reduced. And it all comes back to not enough pilots once again. And I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, my take on this has been sort of consistent. It's like, what the hell are we going to do because we're not making enough new pilots fast enough?
Well, this is the second time we're talking about Horizon because we did talk about them the first time a few weeks ago when the initial note from the chief pilot came out about from Alaska about needing to shift some of the flying. And so clearly, like what we heard a few weeks ago wasn't, you know, it wasn't nearly as dire, but now it clearly is far more dire and far more of a crisis. Which, I mean, it's interesting, right? At a time when airfare is being driven down, I question if we're going to see an increase in airfare to support this, but I don't know if we can actually, if the market will support that.
Well, so yeah, I agree that part of it is just pay them more and then more people will be willing to do the job. But this isn't a job where you can like walk out and find a couple hundred people ready to go. And it's just that they were only making $40,000 a year and now they're making 60 and they're ready to start. The training process is in depth. I mean, where you got the 1500 hour minimums now to get the right type ratings and all those things. There's a sort of funnel and a pipeline that you have to fill, and it's pretty empty. And that's what worries me more than, I mean, yes, these one-off sort of random flights shutting down is bad, but big picture, I feel like it's going to be even worse.
Well, there's nothing that we can do in the short term. The reality is, how do we address for the long term because of the minimums and all that, right? So is this a 12 to 18 month problem, or is this a 4 to 5 year problem? And that's a financial thing.
That's fair.
Right?
That's
if you
fair.
Can incite more people to start the programs and pay them better during the programs, because that's part of it as well. There's a lot of personal burden they have to take during the training process.
Yeah, and so I mean that brings up like JetBlue has an interesting arrangement where they're not directly paying people to become pilots, but they are working with the training facilities, and so the potential new pilots go in for interviews, get qualified, do sort of JetBlue training, new hire stuff. Then go and learn to be pilots, then come back and do another round of JetBlue sort of indoctrination, and then go and make their 1,500 hours by being trainers at the facilities where they learned how to fly. So they basically go back. It's, I guess maybe it's like sort of grad student TA kind of thing. That's okay. Probably the best analogy I can come up with. But they get paid to be this TA of sorts. I mean, it's actually a proper instructor, whatever, but they get paid to teach other pilots how to fly, and then over that time, they build up their 1,500 hours because they're also, flying, doing that, and they get eventually, once they hit their 1,500, then they become real JetBlue pilots, assuming everything goes to plan.
Right, and so, you raise an interesting thing. Part of the challenge around all this is the majors, right? The majors have been growing their narrow-body fleets over the last few years. Yep. And so that's been pulling people out of the regional ranks, which is why the regionals are feeling it so much more, because people are in essence taking promotions and moving up to the big leagues, and they haven't been able to backfill. So if the problem doesn't get addressed in the short haul, it's going to start affecting the majors as the mainline carriers as well.
Trickle up problem instead of a trickle down problem. That's what worries me about it. But You know, the problem is I'm not sure how to fix it. And even if I did know how to fix it, obviously I couldn't, but necessarily. But it's a weird situation, and I'm not sure what the net result is going to be when you see these sort of forecasts from IATA, from Boeing, from Airbus, how many, you know, we're going to add 10,000 new airplanes in the next 20 years. Who the hell is going to fly them?
But the thing I don't understand is this is not a problem that crept up overnight.
No, it's not.
So who's been asleep at the wheel, and why haven't they been addressing it? Now we see, you know, was it ExpressJet who recently terminated a contract with Delta because they didn't want to pay more? There was one mainline, one regional that ended an agreement because the mainline wasn't willing to pay more to help cover the cost that they're seeing as an increase to pull pilots in.
I believe you. I don't know it, but it would surprise me. I think I remember with Republic there was discussion about that where they settled a strike or a potential strike and they came to terms, but then said we're going to have to go back and renegotiate now with all the mainline carriers. And
right.
I don't know what the results of that were, but it would not surprise me to learn that that was one of the ways it's played out.
Yeah. So, I mean, and interestingly here, you know, the regionals are in a great position in that they're in a great position. They're in a bad position. They're in a bad position. They can't grow, but they're in a great position because they now have negotiating power.
Yeah. Well, the counter argument to that, and this is one I heard when I was up at Bombardier last week, I think, was the pilots are no longer so much cheaper. And so when your operating costs go down or go up, the total trip cost goes up enough that you may as well just buy and fly larger planes.
Well, the challenge is while the salary might not be that different, the benefits are.
Yeah, and I think Bombardier was a little nuts in that analysis. I mean, yes, even as total trip costs go up, the jump from 50-seaters to 120-seaters is a little more than probably what the market can bear.
And you and I both know, disproportionately, the revenue comes more from the regional flights than the mainline, because the mainline is where everyone's competing.
Yeah, it's the short, you know, and absolutely the numbers say short-haul, sub-500 nautical mile flights, on average, bring in way more revenue per mile flown and whatever, and per many other metrics than the long haul stuff. So, of course, you still need long haul to make a full sort of operation work, but the short haul stuff absolutely makes money. So it's a matter of balancing that out. Anyway, I think the short answer is we're screwed, and good luck figuring that out.
Well, I think the one question I have is why is Alaska the only mainline really talking about this?
Because they own the regional.
But we don't see anything in the as far as the regional space from the other three, right? So it makes me wonder, are they just not addressing it and just augmenting it with mainline capacity? Or is there something different going on from a financial perspective that we don't know about?
Fair question. Interesting.
It's food for thought. Yeah, I don't think we have the energy.
I wonder, is Alaska just willing to talk about it because they have to because it's their company? Right, the other regionals have been talking about how they can't necessarily staff flights. We've had sort of little scares like this over the past 12 to 18 months where you see a swath of flights get canceled while the regional has to sort of catch up on pilot rest or whatever. But this time, you know, the other interesting comment that came out of this is the original expectation was like, oh yeah, it's just going to take us a couple, you know, weeks to a month and we can fix it. And the latest version is now, I think they're saying mid-2018 at the earliest before things sort of settle down.
Yeah, because there's a ramp-up period.
Yeah. The other interesting thing about this Alaska/Horizon story is when Horizon agreed with their unions to sort of let SkyWest in, because right now Alaska has both as operators, as regionals, they had some guarantees of which planes would be operated where. And the union representing the Alaska pilots is either threatening or has filed suit to ensure that the planes that it was supposed to fly will still be dedicated to it to fly, even though it doesn't have enough pilots to fly them.
So they want their parent to accept delivery of the planes and let them sit there?
That's what it seems. I mean, initially Alaska has deferred a few deliveries to try to get through this, but I sort of get it, but, you know, you want your end of the contract to be maintained, or you want their end of the bargain to be maintained, but if you can't maintain yours by delivering enough people to do the work, it's sort of, I'm skeptical of that approach.
I mean, that sounds like an example of, you know, cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah. But, you know, and obviously there's ways to do things like, how about SkyWest flies them for a year while you get your shit figured out? But who knows? I can imagine that doesn't go so well.
Yeah.
Anywho, are you going to Australia? Morning, are you coming home?
I'm going to Australia. I don't know if I'm coming home at this point. Interesting question. So Air New Zealand, you know, had a what one could consider a fair sale over the weekend, but they are no longer honoring said tickets. Last night,
I saw the Florida activity, but never actually got in on it. So
it basically was 9:44 from Melbourne, Sydney, and I think Brisbane to LA via Auckland in business.
Round trip or one way?
Round trip.
That's a pretty good sale.
Yeah, it's a really good sale. And interestingly enough, you know, the tickets were all issued sometime Sunday. Mm-hmm. It wasn't
Sunday,
until
U.S. time.
Sunday U.S. time. Sunday, I think everywhere.
Well, they're 18 hours ahead of us.
Yeah, but it was loaded in the morning of Sunday.
Okay.
They were loaded. Like I bought my ticket in the afternoon Chicago time.
On Sunday. So that means it was Monday morning and people were awake in Auckland.
Yeah, they were just starting to come online. They didn't cancel them until sometime Tuesday evening. I got my cancellation from Expedia last night.
Bummer.
Yeah.
So have we gone through the 12 stages of grief yet?
Well, you know, there's an entire thread on, you know, the forums, and it's just fun to read about people getting themselves up in arms and, you know, doing this and doing that. And it's like, hey, some you win, some you lose some.
Are we boycotting Air New Zealand? Is that one coming?
Oh, yes. That's come up.
I will never fly them again, and I never would have flown them in the first place unless they given me this ridiculous deal.
But, you know, it raises an interesting question is, you know, from the AA ruling a couple of years ago with the Beijing-Shanghai mistake, what is really, given what airfares, particularly premium cabin airfares, are doing right now, what really is a mistake versus not a mistake?
That's a good question. I know there was, I mean, even more recently, there was an Air Canada similar sort of deal that I actually booked and then got canceled on me. That was, I was 800 premium economy to China return, which honestly isn't, I mean, it was with $300 coach fares being regular and available and viable round trip, like that doesn't necessarily come off as a mistake. Now, I know enough about fare construction that I can look at it and see that there's no fuel surcharge being applied, and I know that that's a mistake, and it should cost $600 more, but...
You're not the average person.
But I'm not the average person, in so many ways.
You don't buy you don't buy tickets based on what the bloggers tell you.
Well, putting that aside, you know, it's interesting to look at how, like you say, like, what is a real fare and what is not anymore, and this wasn't a $0 fare. This wasn't an obvious, like, haha, go screw yourself. Now, it is less than half of what the normal fare is, and so perhaps... If challenged in front of the DOT, Air New Zealand is going to be, say, it is an obvious error because it's less than half. But does that mean a $300 round trip to China also is? Because that's less than half of what it was a year ago?
Well, I mean, as a better example, Steve and I bought Vancouver to Singapore for $2,100 in paid business.
And that was not a mistake.
That was not a mistake, right? Like, where do you draw the line?
Yeah, it's one of those awkward, and this is, you know, it's the pendulum of enforcement and rules and how do you define these things of, yes, it was a mistake, but who has to pay for it, I think is what it comes down to. Like, let's assume that the airlines are honest about saying, we didn't mean to do that, and they do it promptly. Did they really mean to, you know, to load a $1,000 round-trip fare for a couple hours or for a day? Did they mean to do it and they sold too many and they want to back out? Like, that's... Or did they not mean to do it? I guess those are the sort of the two options, and there's obviously many more options, but that's two options if you want to look at it that way. And so do you trust the airline to be honest with enforcement groups saying, you know, consumer protection groups saying, oopsie, it was completely an accident, we'll never do it again, knowing full well that they will absolutely do it again, and also that the consumer has scant few options of similar power, right? The consumer rarely can say, haha, screw you, airline, I'm getting my money back.
Yeah, and I mean, this could, you know, get even more complicated, right? You could, in theory, like if airlines started, one of the things I see is this gives the airlines, the way the rules are currently structured, an airline can really say any fare is a mistake.
Yeah.
If they choose to, so they can back out of it. So if they were to do, because Air New Zealand claims they do flash sales. So me, if they did a flash sale and they sold too many, they could say, oh, it was a mistake.
Yeah, that's the part that worries me. And I'm not sure that there needs to be absolutes necessarily. But there needs to be something better than the airline has full control or the passenger has full control.
And right.
It's easy to argue the passenger doesn't have full control even, you know, 2 years ago when the DOT would sort of require enforcement pretty much in favor of the passenger. You could still say the passenger didn't have full control. But it's, oh, well, good luck getting home.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Yeah. So obviously Air New Zealand business class is nice, and they have lots of seats up there. One of our listeners asked, and sort of based on a discussion in one of said forums that we were referencing earlier, about how do airlines decide, you know, the gist of the question is, how do airlines decide how many business class seats they have on board? And can you tell from how many seats are on board what the airline's passenger makeup is and how it sort of realizes yields and volumes and things like that? Do you think that's a fair summary of the question?
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts on that topic?
I do.
Goody. I want to hear them.
Because I think the one example they recited was United versus Delta. I firmly believe, and I have some anecdotal evidence to support, that United does a far better job of corporate contracts than Delta does. Delta's really focused a little less on corporate contracts in the last few years and more on the nouveau riche, mm-hmm. the stars, the paparazzi type crowd. And you'll see it on like TMZ and stuff. So they just want incremental. They don't really care about long term. They're not worried about building relationships. And that's evident by the things they've done to SkyMiles. They are, you know, all the airlines get accused of being incremental, but I think Delta is far more incremental than any of the others.
Okay. I can buy that. So, I mean, from that perspective, though, as a, I guess, and this sort of becomes a short-term, long-term, and, you know, big picture versus individual flight kind of game. But if I have 30 business class seats that I sell at full price, or I have 50, which take up, you know, 60% more space on board, that I sell at a 20% discount because that all these corporate contracts, and so let's say the blended rate is lower.
Mm-hmm.
Which is better for business? Is there a single answer to that question?
Well, it's really, you know, part of it is risk, looking at the risk profile of it. The one advantage you have when you have these agreements, well, corporate agreements in some cases, you know, the depending on the route, mm-hmm. some airlines will guarantee a certain amount of spend on each route. So you have some performance guarantees. So whether or not they put someone in the seat, they're still buying it.
Right. And that's
The other thing is, right, you know, we're very fortunate in the last few years where money's flowing freely and things are good. But when that starts to get tight, the incremental revenue goes first.
Yeah. So the sort of performance guarantee stuff would be things we consider like the oil routes or the Pharma Express from Raleigh-Durham to London, things like that,
yep.
where specific companies say, we need to make sure that service is going to be there when we need it. So you'll give us a discount on seats, but we'll guarantee we buy X number of them, and exactly when and where and how remains to be seen, but make it happen.
And generally the way those are structured is we will spend X million dollars a year
yeah.
on this route. And then, you know, there's a purse, you know, however they decide to break it up.
Yeah.
And, they can.
You know, and it's when you see, I mean, this is one of the things people complain about, like corporate travel agencies and things like that, and how frustrating they are to, you know, I hate booking in Concur, you'll hear, or whatever it is. And you end up with, you see the pricing, but they use those travel management companies because that's where the discounts get applied.
Well, not just that, but there's, and the other aspect of all this is there's all these back end discounts where when you hit certain threshold, you know, in your contract, you have, when you spend $1 million, we'll give you a 5% rebate. When you spend $30 million, we'll give you a 10%. So, and that's one of the things that you'll often hear from the corporate travel consumer is we're saving like $15 on this, but we're paying Amex $25 a ticket to process. How does this make sense? And it's really the two key reasons corporate travel managers exist is A, one, to manage risk of who's on what flight and what happens if something happens to said flight. And the other is to funnel all the discounts and be able to get those back-end discounts back.
So it's a bigger picture than just, oh, we booked through, you know, we don't just get 10% off. It's a 10%, but it's a sliding scale potentially and things like that. So having someone coordinate and manage all that does bring value to the corporate contract, the corporation.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess my take, and it's an interesting one, just looking at the the Economy Plus world, the legroom space. For years, United was the only one that did that. And right around the Continental merger, when Continental finally saw the books, they were like, holy crap, man, we can make some cash, right? When the merger happened, the expectation, and I think, I don't know if they announced it specifically and publicly, but it was certainly intimated many times, was that Economy Plus was dying.
Yep.
And once they saw the books and saw what that incremental revenue meant, Continental added it, and then so did American and so did Delta. And now United still has way more seats in that cabin than the other two. But the other two now are going to a real premium economy. So does that, and this is a little different than business class, but does that shift the sort of passenger demographic and change the way some of these numbers work in your mind?
So I have a couple thoughts on this. A, let's not forget that in the early 2000s, AA –
You're in the room throughout, Coach, aren't you?
I am. I am. AA also attempted that and failed at it. And so,
did it differently.
The question becomes, what did United do that was different that AA couldn't manage to do the first time? As far as premium economy versus economy plus, my I just have a gut that is premium economy – a gut feeling that as premium economy becomes more prevalent – system-wide upgrades will not be useful towards business. It'll be because they're calling it a separate cabin. They will eventually be good for economy to premium economy or premium economy to business.
And Delta already does that. So if you're using a Delta on Air France.
Right. I was going to say, I don't think Delta does that yet.
They haven't done it straight up on their own metal yet, but they did it if you're flying on Air France. And they also only have the one fleet type. The 350s are the only planes with premium economy so far. So it will be in the 777s. I don't remember if they've announced they're getting it or not. There's one type that I'm not sure about. But
the 6s are definitely not getting it.
The 76s?
Yeah, because they're so old at this point. They're aging out.
You know, can you implement that policy of only upgrade to the one cabin if it's not consistent fleet-wide? That would be hard.
And well, you could, right? Because they've introduced W, so
one class. Oh, it becomes a sort of at the whim of the airline, what does my system-wide get me? Like, I'm flying to London so I can upgrade to business, but I'm flying to China so I can't. But if I fly to China from, you know, Portland or Japan from Portland where it's a 767, then I can. Like, I feel like that they could do that, obviously. And, you know, airlines do things like that to piss people off all the time. But I feel like they'd be doing something just to piss people off.
And you think the airline would care about that?
I think it creates enough confusion around the program that it might actually – it's not that they're pissing people off. It's that it's creating confusion.
Or they might not do it until they've got a fleet-wide or the majority of the fleet done, right?
Right. And so if the 76s aren't doing it, then you get a question of how long does that take or retirement or whatever, and how are you going to get there? That's
all viable questions.
Yeah. And there's middle ground options of you can upgrade from Y or B to business, or Y, B, and M can go all the way to business, but, you know, whatever's below that, U and V and T and S and whatever can only go into premium economy, and maybe the K and whatever at the very bottom still can't upgrade at all.
Well, but I think that makes it even more complicated. Remember that the average person does not pay attention to the fare bucket.
Sure. But you know, United has trained its passengers who have system-wides pretty well on understanding the W fare minimum.
Well, yes and no. The ones we talk to. But there's still tons of people who don't even realize what 1K means. And they're 1K.
Yeah. That's right? Fair.
And so it's hard. Sometimes it's hard, right, to understand what the rest of the population, how they behave. But it's always interesting to watch and talk to people who are not in this sphere.
Yeah.
Because it gives you a different perspective. And others, I mean, I've met people who are platinum and gold and 1K, and they have no idea what that actually gets them.
That is a fair point. But the short answer, I mean, going back to this sort of original question we started with, it's definitely a different customer demographic. Do you think it's reasonable to say one is necessarily more or, you know, better or worse in terms of revenue toward versus costs and things like that? Or is it just sort of, you know, the way it is?
Well, I mean, so, you know, I have a couple of thoughts on this. And, you know, premium economy versus economy plus. One World, I wonder if they're being – if AA is being pushed by One World to have a true premium economy cabin. And I don't have an answer to that. But, you know, they did this push to have lie-flat to London as a mandatory thing. So that was one of the first routes that they guaranteed it on. And so I wonder if it's an alliance thing. I think at the end of the day, it's really going to boil down to if the revenue is there, it'll stay. If the revenue is not there, it's not going to stay.
Yeah.
And, you know, to what you were saying earlier, I would argue that most YBM fares on international are more expensive than W's.
The premium comes. Yeah, they have been in my experience. I mean,
yeah.
Right. We've talked about this a little bit on the show for the past 9 months or so. I've been flying a ton of BA World Traveler Plus.
Right.
Because it was cheap. I was doing 600 euro round return from Berlin, and my most recent one was like 800 US, so like 700 euro from Zurich or Geneva.
Yeah. I mean, how do you say no to that?
It's a little bit of a pain to have to, you know, fly to Switzerland to position for that, but for the $80 I'm paying on EasyJet or whatever, plus sometimes I'm doing it same day, sometimes I'm connecting through. Even adding that in, if you add it in, it's 1,000 return, that's still a good value on premium economy compared to what the list price is in many cases, and easy to upgrade.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do one-way in business, it's even better.
As long as you don't change your plans.
Yeah. Well, like any ticket, though. I mean,
well, don't you lose the obvious when you upgrade it?
Oh, yes. If you change and the new flight doesn't have upgrade space available at the time, you lose your obvious. I did get screwed on that. So I still they still never figure out how to charge me for the flight change, though, so I don't know.
It's a wash.
Yeah, I still think I lost out a little bit, but I'm getting over it. Air Canada has the 737 MAX coming soon to a transatlantic route near you. And after all this talk of business class, the premium cabin on that is not going to be so businessy.
No, it looks more like domestic first. But, I mean, they are short flights. They're in the summer.
Yeah, but it's still Toronto or Montreal to Ireland.
Yeah, but I think it's probably – Montreal to Ireland is probably not that much different than St. John to Heathrow.
Yeah, it's like a 5 hour. I can check block time while we're talking here, but I think it's probably like five and a half in the air.
And they've done St. John to Heathrow for years on a 319. Yeah. I mean, but it's interesting. Like, you know
– And they've bruised a bunch of routes. So like at that point, what's the difference?
Good verbiage of that. You've been rouged. But so, you know, it's funny. Like, we see this massive influx of 737 MAXs going into Ireland now between Norwegian, between Air Canada. God knows who else is going to jump in on that bandwagon. So who's going to open a 737 maintenance base in Ireland?
That's a good question.
Because Aer Lingus is Airbus. They're not Boeing.
Yeah. Its block time is 6.5 hours from Toronto to Shannon.
Okay.
So, yeah, 5 and change in the air.
Yeah, Toronto's a little further than Montreal, but Montreal to I think Montreal is
Dublin is the other route, so both are a little further.
Yeah, so they're a little – I suspect Montreal to Dublin is pretty close to St. John Heathrow.
Yeah, 6:10 from Montreal to Dublin.
But, I mean, and it's like all the routes to Iceland, right? Iceland Air has a domestic first product. I mean
I'm sorry. It's a five-hour flight for St. John's to London, which is a five-hour block time.
Which is a red eye.
Yeah, that's worse than domestic red eyes in San Francisco to New York.
That's almost a mid-con.
Yeah. That WestJet actually flies St. John's to Dublin.
Oh, there you go.
Block time of 4 hours and 32 minutes.
I thought they also flew St. John Gatwick, but I could be wrong.
They might. I'm just, you know, that'll be similar timing to the Heathrow flight.
Yeah,
they do. Exactly. That's just over five. Yeah, a 4 hour and 32 minute red eye across the Atlantic. I can't imagine the smart play there is to try to sleep on board. I mean,
the question in the summer, do you even get much darkness at that point? Because you're so far north.
Yeah. Out the window, it stays light the whole time, you think?
Yeah.
Or close to it.
Or dusk.
Yeah. It's certainly duskish, depending on exactly when during the season you're flying it. But anyway, I don't know. The other interesting thing about the MAX is that they announced it's going to have more premium seating in premium-ish seating and coach, so extra legroom, going back to our conversation earlier. And Air Canada has said, and I have the numbers here, I'll pull them up and make sure I get them right. They said, with 169 total seats on their existing fleet, they've seen something like a, where I saw that, 30% increase year over year in fees paid for better seats within the coach cabin.
Remember when you could just get the exit row because you asked for it?
I do.
It was a kinder, gentler time.
You know, but you hear them saying this, and so much like the U.S. carriers had previously, they are realizing that these sort of extra legroom seats generate the revenue. People are willing, or a subset of people are willing to pay to not hate themselves when they get off the plane.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting, you know, I attended a press conference with XL Airways, which is a French low-cost carrier. They fly wide bodies, and they fly a 9 abreast A330, which is 400 seats on an A330, 300 series.
Sardines.
It is a massive number of people for that aircraft, and they fly it back and forth across the Atlantic multiple times a day with different routes and such, and especially in the summer, they sell it out because there's enough people. The CEO yesterday, his comment was, would you pay €800 more for an 8-hour flight or for 8 days of hotel? And for enough people, that's the difference in what your trip costs is, right? I mean, for some people, I can either afford the trip because I now have this €800 different for hotel, or I can't. And if they can build the cost structure to be able to operate that profitably, who are we to, you know, hate them for it?
Well, I mean, you raise a really interesting point because I was recently having a discussion with someone. They're like, I don't really care about the airline experience. I just suck it up as part of getting to my destination and getting to go home.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just people have been programmed to say, I don't care about that. Like, it's going to be a miserable experience. I'll do what I can, and I'll survive. But I at least get to go on vacation.
Yeah, and, you know, it's I think you're right. To some level, we've been conditioned that air travel sucks in so many ways. But also, like, you know, oh my God, I would die if I had to fly to Hong Kong and coach. No, you wouldn't. I mean, small risk of deep vein thrombosis and, you know, blood clot or whatever. But you actually probably won't die. Like, thousands of people do it every day.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah.
I kid, of course.
I know. But, like, and I've gotten a little, you know, grumpy about this sort of thing, and this year still have not crossed the Atlantic on a sleeping flight in coach, because I've decided that for me it's worth it to find these cheap premium economy fares, or in some cases I'm just getting business class tickets. But, you know, I'll do coach on the daytimes, and I haven't done it this year, but last year or the year before I did Hong Kong to Newark in an economy plus seat, middle seat, and I still could if I had to, right? That's, at some point, though, and that was the case of that's what it took so we could go on the vacation.
I mean, it's a matter of priorities, right? You can always make a compromise, and the average person compromises on the airline experience because they really just see it as an incremental, I only benefit from this for a few hours versus days.
Yeah. And I mean, and I'm one of those people for the most part. When I splurge, it is more often on lodging, and I splurge in the sense of getting myself where I want to be more than like the property type. I don't like a Four Seasons stay generally. Because I like going out and not being on property the whole time. But
right.
I will splurge on being in the right location or, you know, cute little boutique-y places, usually before I buy a nice plane ticket. So
I agree.
Where's my list of topics? We're supposed to talk about one other thing. Oh, gumdrops.
Oh, no, not my gumdrop buttons.
Delta is dumping the Guam route. They fly Guam Narita, and it's one of the sort of beach markets, and they've flown it for a long time. It's an old Northwest route. How much of this is deconstructing the Narita hub that sort of no longer is relevant? And how much of it is, do you think, sort of a commentary on Japan to tourism destinations and things like that?
Well, it was interesting. You know, I was reading one of the articles about it, and I hadn't realized that the Guam tourism base had shifted from Japan to Koreans as the number one. I mean, that was like where all the Japanese used to go to vacation. So yeah. I now question, where are they going?
Why?
I mean, Hawaii is easier to get to, right? Thanks to that Hawaiian flight.
And just way more flights in general overall. I mean, it's not just Hawaiian. United flies it, Delta flies it.
United and Delta have flown it for years.
Right.
Right. That's nothing new. And really, I was just kidding about the Hawaiian thing.
Okay.
But that's
– are we going back to like the bitching the other guys had about the Haneda routes and
yes.
the flight times because it was only for Japanese visitors? Right. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. But the Hawaiian flight really is the only lift, because the reality is lift has gone down on those routes, because remember, Northwest and United both served them with 747s, and now they're 777s.
Yeah.
So capacity has gone down. And I mean, JAL, ANA, they also all did 7.4s, and no one's doing a 7.4 anymore. So capacity did go down. Hawaiian just backfilled some of it. So maybe they are going there.
And ANA is going to bring the A380s in.
And I didn't know that, but yes. So that'll be another boost in capacity. So clearly there's a market. They're not really exploring any of the other Hawaiian islands because none of the planes can make it.
Yeah.
Now, there's a possibility with the 7.8s that they might be able to go, but to Maui, because that's the second largest runway, I think. But I don't know if they'll actually do that. But it's interesting. And so – but I do think part of it is, you know, Delta's reduced the amount of feed coming into Hawaii into Tokyo, so they can't carry those people onto Guam or vice versa. So if you're in Guam and you need to go somewhere in the mainland, you can either connect through Tokyo or go through Honolulu. If you're going through Tokyo, if Delta doesn't have a lift to get you where you want, you're likely going to go with United or ANA or something.
Yeah, it's United and JAL are going to continue to serve it. And
right.
United can, I think, is part of the joint venture with ANA. I'd have to double check, but it should be because it's U.S. to Asia.
Right, and I believe, and as far as I know, they are. So that, and that's the thing, right? Delta has no one to partner with in Tokyo, whereas both JAL
and that's been the problem for the Delta Tokyo hub since, you know, the past decade, basically.
Yeah, but Northwest made it work.
Northwest made it work, but Northwest made it work back in an era when no one else, like when the competition was dramatically different, and also when the feed into China, the feed into Southeast Asia, all had to go through Tokyo. There's a lot of overflights now.
Right, but not. I mean, they've dropped Bangkok. I think they've dropped Singapore. They have Hong Kong from Seattle. But what else do they have in Southeast Asia at this point? They've just been dropping routes altogether.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, where I wonder is, I think we're starting to slowly see a shift from Narita to Seoul given that the Korean relationship's gotten better. So it'll be interesting if Delta considers spinning up Guam, Seoul, but or the other.
Is that not served by a Korean already?
It is, but
Jeju Air, Jeju Air, and all the others.
I'm sure it is, and part of it, you know, let's be real, it's a 7.5 these days. Part of it could just be it's time to get rid of the 7.5.
Yeah,
right. Those 7.5s are some of the oldest out there, so it's probably this is probably a fleet play, and they're not because they have minimal connecting traffic in Narita and no one to partner with. It just doesn't make fiscal sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the 7.5. Just another story that I thought I'd bring up because we've talked about it. Out of that same XL Airways press conference I was talking about, the company also owns La Compagnie, the 752s back and forth between JFK and or Newark and Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And the CEO said yesterday that they will be announcing an A321 order in the next couple weeks.
Oh.
So 75s starting to retire in some cases. I can't quite tell if this is sort of the scenario of, you know, we bought the old cheap plane to see if it would work, and now that we know that it sort of works, we can go and invest in a better product.
Right.
Also, like, the planes are old and kind of need to be replaced.
Yeah, I mean, the 7.5s, you know, I think United has some of the youngest ones from the Continental acquisition, and I think they are 20 years old now.
Yeah, we're getting to that point. They need the MOM/NMA, the 797 needs to happen.
Yes.
Because the 321 is good for some routes, but won't serve all of the 752 needs, and
nope.
Nor will the MAX 10. And that's,
nope.
And United's on the hook for the MAX 10 right now, so we'll see.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens, but it is getting to the point where they have to do something.
All righty. What's your next trip? Where are you going?
Where am I going? I'm going to Manchester and Amsterdam this weekend.
Fun.
Yeah, that'll be good. And I actually get to stay for a little bit, so that'll be even better.
Are you going to get your combo non in Manchester again?
I might. I'm actually toying with the idea of just hopping a train going down to London. But the jumbo non is definitely on the list if I stay in Manchester.
Yeah. Very nice. Very
yeah. Nice. What about yourself?
I'm going out to the West Coast for a week. There's the Dorkfest/plane spotting between NYC Aviation and Phoenix Plane Spotters. It's a ridiculous scene where a bunch of people hang out at In-N-Out and various other plane spotting locations. So that's on Saturday. If you're lucky enough to listen to this early, come on out and hang out by In-N-Out. And then at, you know, Sepulveda, right by LAX. And then the Airline Passenger Association Apex Expo, one of the big trade shows I go to every year, is in Long Beach next week. So I will be out there being, you know, my awesome reportery self.
And you do know you can no longer use the parking spot shuttle?
I do. I think maybe I only took it once. I almost always just walk.
Oh, well, there you go.
The 25 is getting, you know, the double-double.
No, I mean, the weather's always pretty much always nice, yeah, so it's a great walk.
There's like a couple times you can stop and you're under the lights and near the approach lights, and you're actually under the planes as opposed to slightly offset. There's some neat bits and neat views you get from there.
Well, and the reality is, given how bad traffic is at the terminals, it probably takes you just as long.
As long as it's not raining, which happens from time to time, but as long as it's not raining, I usually walk it.
Well, and I don't know if you know this, but if you come out of the Terminal 8 side, walk down to the end there. You can actually walk across the old tower, and then from there you can walk into this little garden area that
9/11 Memorial.
There you go, and which will put you right on Sepulveda.
I do that frequently. It's actually a really nice garden and really nice memorial that doesn't see a lot of action.
Yeah. No, every time I stay at one of the airport hotels, I'll do that walk. I'll stop there, and it's just a nice, relaxing walk before you get on your flight.
Awesome. Well, you can find us online at moredotsmorelines.com or on Twitter at dotslines, and leave us a comment, send in more questions. Thanks to the boat for sending in this one today, and we'll talk to you soon. Have a great trip.
Take care.